3:35. We have two items before us today. We have a quorum with Senator McGuire, Senator Stedman, Huggins, Wilkowski, and my good friend Tom Wagner. And the first item we have before us today will be H.J.R. 31, Post Federal Law Reference Aerial Hunting, and that's Mr. Jim Pound, staff to Representative Keller and led by Representative Keller. If you would put yourself on the record, we'd be proud to hear from you.
Thank you, Chair Huggins and committee. My name is Wes Keller. I'm a representative of District 14, and I thank you for hearing this resolution. In September of 07, Congressman George Miller of California introduced H.R. House Resolution 3663. And rather than try to describe it, I'm just going to read a couple sentences that how somebody else has. Here's the Defenders of Wildlife says that the resolution expressly prohibits aerial gunning or land and shoot gunning of wolves and other predators for the purpose of inflation of the game species populations. And then the Wolf Conservative Center says that this resolution bars states from using aerial hunting to artificially boost game species populations for hunters. You probably remember, but the bill was introduced on the Capitol steps, and they had that to the wolf there, and it was with a lot of fanfare. Just an interesting aside, the resolution has a exemption in there if the wolves are raising a problem for livestock in Lower 48, then they can go ahead and use the airplanes, go out and shoot, whatever. And what that tells me right there, I mean, just that one little thing, I mean, they have the roads down here, we don't have the roads up here, you know, they just don't understand. I mean, they really don't understand our culture. Like you, I mean, I've been fortunate, probably many of you, fortunate to go all over the state, rural Alaska, and you see that moose and caribou and salmon are just staples of the diet, and some other things I might add that you have to build a taste for in some of the rural areas, but I mean, it's a staple. And that's our job, is to manage these things to make, you know, for maximum beneficial use of the people. Alaska is a sovereign state, has sovereign borders, and we manage our wildlife for abundance. And the legislature has been given the job of ultimately of setting the policy, and we've been doing so, as you know, with the Board of Game, and we've done quite well. I mean, there's been evidences of success over the years. In 1959, when we just after we became a state, the salmon were in trouble, and we managed that. And there's been many, many examples over time. Lest you think this is not that important of a resolution, I just want to point out, the last I checked, there's 111 co-sponsors on the resolution, and it hasn't had a hearing yet. I don't know exactly what that means, but I just went online and found them, and sure enough, there's 111 of them there, all listed. So with that, I won't say any more. I would encourage your passage of this resolution. Thank you.
Okay. Senator McGuire, and let the record show that Senator Green and Senator Stevens has joined us. Please.
Thank you, Representative Keller, for introducing this. My question to you is, do you know what the impetus was? Is there a particular group or groups that were behind introducing this, and was it targeted toward Alaska, in your opinion?
I have no, through the chair, Senator McGuire, I have no specific names of groups, but I did some checking, and I found some pretty interesting stuff. I have an acquaintance who lives in California, and he says he works, I don't have the name in front of me, but he called it a public relations firm. And they hire a huge staff, and they go just look for issues like this, you know. And what they do is they, for a percentage of what they can raise, they build a media campaign, and they go in and they target, you know, on the issue. And interestingly enough, they'll take any side of the issue, sometimes both at the same time. So I can't, all I know for sure is that when Congressman Miller introduced it on the Capitol steps, the president of the Defenders of Wildlife was there with him, as was the center, Wolf Conservation Center. But I don't know specifically, you know, how the word of bill came from.
Thank you.
Other questions for Representative Keller? Seeing none, Representative Keller, I'm sorry, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I certainly don't appreciate Congress telling us what to do here in Alaska either, but do you have any concern about the fact that Alaskans have voted twice to ban airborne hunting?
I think airborne hunting has been banned. I think what they do is they you do predator control now with airplanes, and I don't see that in defiance of the will of the people. I don't see that as a problem.
Senator Wagner?
I'd just like to make a statement that while a lot of people are against the airborne hunting as we currently have it, I've had a lot of constituents in my area say that they would not be opposed to the state of Alaska hiring helicopters and doing the airborne control of wolf populations, nor would they be against having a bounty on them. So it's just a however you want the process done. So I think this is a good resolution. I'll certainly be voting for it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Green.
Senator Wagner, is that in as opposed to an individual flying? Or I mean, you said the Department of,
they want their
personnel to do it?
Where their concern has been expressed to me is they're not sure how many wolves that are shot get reported. And I don't see any advantage for not reporting the number of wolves killed, but at the same time, you can pretty well tell if a wolf pack's being thinned out enough because aerial counts at certain times of the year are pretty easy to make.
Yeah, I agree with that. From the people I've talked to, no matter which side of the issue you're on, by and large, sometimes it's semantics of how it's described because they understand the dire condition of the game population, and it's one of the things that has to be addressed. Otherwise, you just the herd goes away. I mean, 16B, where I've hunted since 1975, there's no moose season. And people understand that we have to do something, and they're supportive, and sometimes they're not supportive of the full means that are being used. Representative Keller, Congressman Miller is from California, right?
That's right.
They have any wolves in California?
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure they do. They must have.
But they have some big cats.
They have big cats, and I think there's some prohibit. They've had some problems with big cats eating people down in California, as I recall, or mauling. Yeah, mauling on them and having fang marks on them, and I think there's, as I recall, there's some review of whether or not the season factor should be readdressed because of, I mean, cats are they're good hunters and they reproduce quickly if they don't have and they don't have any natural enemies other than us. And if we're just feeding them with our bodies, it doesn't work out very well. Other questions? I think, and I could speak only for myself, this resolution is straightforward, readily apparent what its intent is, and the Alaskans I've talked to are fully supportive in the sense that they understand it's a tool that should be available, and they may debate about, you know, the tool's utility in some scenarios. So with that, any other comments on the resolution? Okay. I have a motion. Senator Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move out to H.J.R. 31 with the attached official note and individual recommendations.
Okay. Is there objections? Seeing none, congratulations, Representative Keller, to moving out H.J.R. 31. And congratulations.
Thank you. My first experience on the dark side is not as bad as I thought.
I forget. Thanks. And we'll take about a 3 minute at ease here.
Yeah, that's right. You're at home here.
will come back to order. Next is House Bill 370, Protection of Forested Lands. And we have Mr. Derek Miller here with a nice fresh haircut. And online, we have Mr. Lynn Wilcock, who used to be one of my neighbors, Division of Forestry, and Jennifer Uhas, Fairbanks North Star Borough, that will be online. And we have Chris Masich, is that right? Yep, okay. Here from DNR, Division of Forestry. And with that, Derek, please put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Derek Miller, and I'm staff to represent Mike Kelly. And before you is House Bill 370, which is a simple bill that would align statute with the Alaska Interagency Wildland Fire Management Plan that's been in effect since approximately 1985 and states that all fire management decisions will be based on values warranting protection. This is to include cabins, lodges, and other man-made structures. Under existing statutory language, it's implied that fire management decisions are based solely on the value of the natural resources at risk and not these other man-made or structural values. This bill does not obligate to protect. It just allows for management to include these structures in their decision-making. Another main objective of the bill is to change the term forest fire to wildland fire throughout statute. This term is used in the Division of Forestry and is a more updated, regular term used throughout the department. This bill also has 2-0 fiscal notes attached, and the Department of Law assures us that the state doesn't take on any additional liability with the passage of this bill. That's kind of the nuts and bolts of the bill, and this little two-page handout provided by the Division of Forestry is a really good handout for the impetus of why this was introduced and why they approached us to introduce this bill. So with that, I can take any questions. There's Chris Mesh is available, and he's much more knowledgeable of this subject than I am, but I'm available for questions or comments.
Yeah, Chris, why don't you come on forward here in case you're, and put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Mesh. I am the Division Director and State Forester.
Yeah, very good. And if you would, Chris, if just give us an overview about how this emerged, and I know we have, but just so everybody would cross level.
Right. Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess this would go back to 2004, which, of course, was a record season here in Alaska. 2004 season, the 2005 season combined almost a little over 11 million acres burned in Alaska. And the interagency fire management plan that all the suppression agencies work with here in the state dictates the four different levels of initial attack suppression. So when a fire initially starts, be it by lightning or by human causes, we refer to the plan for the type of initial attack response we're going to have. There are two types of responses that are referred to as limited and modified. And of course, as they sound, limited means that a fire may or may not be attacked, yet there are often structures located in these portions of the state that currently often do not receive protection. And that goes back to what the actual policy is for structures on state lands in limited protection areas. Generally speaking, a structure gets the same type of protection as the surrounding area. So if the surrounding area is in limited protection, then generally the structure is not protected. And there are some exceptions to that if human life are at risk. But essentially that's how the policy has worked for many years. There's been more and more development in the remote parts of the state, more structures built, and it was time to update what we refer to as the fire atlases. The atlases show where structures are located and the level of protection a structure may get. The administration, Murkowski administration, actually brought forth an effort that was called our best effort doctrine, and they ran that by the Department of Law to see if we could do something where we would provide protection for structures in these areas. And under the reading of the current statute where it says natural resources at risk, the Department of Law determined that we could not indeed protect structures in those circumstances. So that's a rather long way to get to the question you asked, but essentially this statute would allow us to develop a system that would let us systematically determine on the atlases whether a structure would or wouldn't receive protection. And that decision would be based on a number of things. One would be if a structure had firewise principles around it, which means the private owner of the structure has conducted firewise activities to make the structure more survivable should a wildfire approach. Is there a close water source? What kind of fuel type is the structure located in? If it's middle of black spruce with no water anywhere nearby, there's not much any of our firefighters are going to be able to do to protect a structure like that. So there'll be a decision tree that each area office of the state could go through when we update the atlases and consistently apply the policy and the standards that, so that all structures are treated equally in the state. And so that's essentially the reason this statute was proposed. Department of Law has been very involved in looking at the language to make sure that, as Derek said, there's not additional liability that the state would undertake with the statute, and they feel that there would be no additional
Senator Wagner?
Is Caribou Hills Fire on state land or private land or a combination?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, a combination of lands are involved in that particular incident. Most of it is on state, and some of it is on the wildlife refuge, about a third of it, if I remember
correctly. How many of those structures were on state land? You know, I've got a structure on state land that's on the other side of the inlet, and it may be different because I think that's a different classification of the area, maybe over the duck flats. But my lease, once it runs out, the state's going to come in and burn the building or remove it. Caribou, are these leases different that people are on state lands? Are the leases different than that?
Through the chair, or Senator Wagner, it depends on the individual piece of private property. I know some of the structures there are trespass structures on state land. Some are permitted structures, and some are just private inholdings, which originally came either from state or federal land. So there's a mixture of different circumstances.
The trespasses, then, they will, if they're burned, they're gone, right?
Yeah, the state policy is that we do not provide structure protection on trespass structures.
But are they going to be able to, Mr. Chairman, are they going to be able to rebuild those structures, or are they going to be permitted to rebuild them?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I actually don't know the answer to that. It would be a good question for Division of Mine, Land, and Water, who oversees that aspect of permitting on state land. So that would be a decision-making process that would be held by that division.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Wilkowski. Yeah,
I don't think my head's working today. I'm just still trying to figure out what exactly this bill does. So I see page 2, it changes forest to wildland. Is that a significant change, or is
Through the chair, Senator Wachowski, no, the wildland fire is certainly just an update of terminology. Around the country, it used to be forest fire. Everyone called it forest fire, but there's other types of lands like the tundra up north this year. We had a 250,000-acre fire that burned in tundra that has no trees. There's grasslands and rangelands in the west. So wildland fire is just a more inclusive term of the types of places that burn. And so it's just an updating of the terminology. That's why you see the different sections. Basically, a word search was done on all statutes to define where the term forest fire had been used. And wherever it had been, it's just simply being replaced with wildland fire.
Where's the meat of this bill?
The meat is in Section 3. And if you look, it's actually on page 3, right at the very top. It's 4115.010, where it says intent. And that section sums up this whole statute, and what it does is it inserts it removes the words value of the resources and for the natural resources and watersheds. Okay. And what it does is it simply inserts values at risk. So values being a more broader term that allows us to include man-made structures as part of the assessment process, which we have done under the Interagency Management Plan. And finally, when this law was originally put in place, it was not a big an issue. There weren't many structures out in the real remote areas of the state. And as the state has developed, it's become more of an issue. But that is the meat of the statute.
And I guess the thing that kind of threw me was that that's in intent language. And usually intent language just doesn't have a whole lot of real meaning. but you're saying it for you it does in this case.
Yes, through the chair. Yes, it does. And we were a little bit surprised by that when law took the previous administration to look at this best effort doctrine that the that Governor Murkowski wanted us to use. And they essentially told him that under this statute we could not actually do that. And so I don't know if that's a more narrow read than what would have been read years ago, but certainly it it meant we needed to update the statute. Mm-hmm.
Just a broader question. I've heard that the way forest fires have been managed for decades, maybe years and years ago, has led to more forest fires. And I guess what I've heard and read is that when forest fires were allowed to take their natural course, then they kind of burned out some of the smaller undergrowth, and then the big heavy fire resistant trees tended to remain more fireproof. And I guess what's happened now is that by killing some of the fires early on for decades and decades, we've kind of loaded up the forest now to the point where, particularly with the beetle kill and everything, it's much more potentially explosive. And I know it's a kind of a broader topic, but just curious to hear your take on that.
Yeah, through the chair of the center. Yes, you're correct. In terms of, especially in the West, here in Alaska, it's a little bit different because the boreal forest is such a fire-driven ecosystem in the first place. Those, the trees and the plants we have here are designed to burn. They need to burn in order for that ecosystem to stay healthy. So that's the beauty of the interagency fire management plan we have. It allows us to manage fire and let it burn when there's fewer resources and values at risk, but where we have communities, you know, we take aggressive initial attack action. But throughout the West, this has been an issue. The Yellowstone fires are a prime example where they kept fire out of that ecosystem for decades and decades, and then when they did have a fire, it was the fuel loads were so heavy, the fire burned at a much more catastrophic intensity than it ever would have if natural fire had been allowed to burn through that area more frequently. And so that's a lot of the problem we're faced across all the western U.S. Some of that's driven by other external factors. Climate change is one of the big issues. It's a lot of people believe are causing some of the more intense fire seasons in addition to just fuels.
And just one last question, Mr. Chair. So in the eastern portion of Anchorage, South Anchorage, and near where I live, East Anchorage, there's a big concern, particularly on the hillside, about forest fires there. And will this language change help that at all? And I guess the second question is, are we doing what we need to do to protect the people there from forest fires? I know it's a little bit off topic, but just
sure. Through the chair to Senator, this actually wouldn't affect the hillside situation because that area is already identified as, I would guess, it's a critical or a full in terms of the type of fire protection it would get. But one thing that is being done on the hillside and in Anchorage community is a community wildfire protection planning where neighborhoods in different parts of the larger urban area are doing these wildfire protection plans that identify where there's areas of high risk, and then mitigation measures are being taken to either reduce the fuels. I mentioned the FireWise principles earlier to educate the residents about what they can do on their own property to make it more I always hate to use the word fireproof. It's to be able to survive a fire if the area burns, or improve the chances that your structure might survive a fire. So those are the kinds of things that are taking place in the urban area. This mainly affects structures that would be in limited or modified protection areas, and those are the areas that we've seen more conflict, at least in terms of the structure issue over the last decade.
Thank you.
Chris, beetle kill. Some number of years back, and I think it probably still lingers to some degree down where Senator Wagner's from and up where I'm from and the connecting parts, there was this debate about beetle kill timber and whether it could be harvested, could it be marketed, should it just be burnt? Could you just give us about a 3 minute or less lesson on where we are in beetle kill and where we've been?
Yeah, bark beetle obviously has been a big problem on the Kenai, has been moving into other parts of the Anchorage Bowl and some of those areas. As far as overall, the beetle's in decline in the state right now. We do annual pest surveys that monitor that and where the actual activity is occurring. As far as salvage activities on the Kenai, that program is really wound down, although just this past year we did sell out of the Kenai office. We've had a series of salvage sales on the books, and a company that is interested in doing a wood pellet manufacturing facility on the Kenai came in and purchased about 20 million feet of the, or basically the remaining salvage sales that we had on the Kenai. The wood is fairly low quality at this point. It's not good for sawing lumber. That usually happens about 3 years after it either burns or is attacked by beetles. As long as the trees stay standing, don't fall over, you can salvage that material for beams or three-sided logs for cabins, things like that that can be sawn. We already did the paper chips that were the chipping operations on the Kenai. Those trees now aren't even good for paper chips. So one of the last things they could be used for is bioenergy, so fuel for bioenergy pellets or just wood chips. And so that's probably about the last option we have to see any additional significant utilization of that material. But you're right, it does fall over eventually. We have grass that grows up, which causes a light fuel problem, and then you have those dead trees down in the grass. So it is a fairly serious fuel loading issue where you have that kind of activity.
There's a term, I'll call it control burn. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the current terminology is.
That's the right term.
Okay. Would you give us a three-minute or less lesson update on that process?
Yeah. Actually, we often refer to it as prescribed fire, but it's actually, you know, a controlled activity. We do some prescribed burning in the state of Alaska. Most of it's up in the interior, and it's been actually for grouse habitat improvement in aspen stands in the spring. Before green up, it's a perfect time to burn those stands and regenerate them into young growth, especially aspen is a clonal species, so it regenerates and sprouts very quickly, which makes the ideal habitat for these grouse as well as other species. We haven't done a lot of prescribed fire for fuels treatment. There's been a few fires like that. The Alphabet Hills is one that comes to mind out in the Copper River area. There was one on the Kenai a few years ago that the Forest Service did, and I'm trying to remember the name of that one. It was down near, I want to say it was near Skelak Lake, but I can't remember the name of the burn. But prescribed fire can be used to help manage fuel conditions and reduce risk. The trick is, if you're going to do it anywhere close to an urban area, you better really have your act together to make sure that you're within the prescription.
Well, we have this provision.
Well, actually, the state has a very good a law in place that as long as the division is acting within their training, their capability, that it has a discretionary immunity statute that protects the state from much litigation.
Right. I'll jump back to the beetle kill very quickly. How long does the tree residue maintain its BTU value?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For quite some time, the BTU value doesn't degrade very rapidly. Once the tree really starts to decompose or rot, you know, like if it's soft, if you can stick your finger into it or rip a chunk out fairly easy, that's a point when it's actually lost BTU value. But as long as that wood stays standing, it actually dries fairly well on the stump, especially in the interior parts of the state. Kenai is pretty good for that too. That wood can last 20, 30 years and be in good condition. We're still harvesting wood for sawing off the Atok River fire, which is all, I think, almost 15 years now since that,
wow,
that occurred.
But wow,
Atok is very dry. I mean, I think it's 9 inches a year of rainfall.
Right.
So,
am I correct in assuming that when the timber freezes in the wintertime, that's just like preserving it in your freezer?
Well, it certainly, it doesn't, there's no decomposition activity taking place, so yeah, you're right. It's pretty much holding it in place. Most of that would occur during the
right. Senator Wilikowski.
Is there any plan to deal with the spruce bark beetle kill down in the Kenai? It seems like that's just a massive fire waiting to happen.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Rakowski, there has been a lot of work down there. It's there's all the communities. I think there's, I want to say, a dozen now that have done these community wildfire protection plans. And the idea behind these planning efforts are public safety, so to help identify evacuation routes, what you do if there actually is a fire, But more importantly, it maps the fuel types, the fuel loads, and where you do have infrastructure, where things are at risk. And then it identifies the level of risk, and then that's where we spend the money or the limited funds we do have to try and mitigate that risk. One option would be prescribed fire, but generally close into communities, we use what we call mechanical fuel treatments. So we'll go in and actually use mechanical means to reduce the fuel loads. It might mean removing the trees in a salvage program. That would be preferable because that means we're actually generating a little revenue. But most of that's already been done that can be done on the Kenai unless this biomass option takes up. What we're doing then is going in and removing fuels from places like close to a school or a residential development, especially if there's topography, you know, where you have a slope with dead trees on it and then homes at the top of that slope. Well, that's obviously a high-risk situation. So we're making a small dent in that risk factor on the Kenai, but it would take a lot more resources than we currently have to make a huge dent in that situation.
Yeah. One other question. You're defining destructive agent in here, and mm-hmm. is that just cleanup, or is there a particular reason you need that?
No, through the chair, Senator. Destructive agent actually refers to the forest practices section of the statute. Forest practices law is also part of Title 41. That's the law that governs activities on private, municipal, and state lands for forest practices, which is generally commercial forestry activities. But one aspect is destructive agents, which are insects like bark beetles and pathogens. Say a shipment of logs came in from British Columbia and they were infested with like in Michigan right now, the great example is it's called the emerald ash borer. These insects came in from overseas on pallet material that was green, and the insect is now infesting ash trees in I think it's in 6 or 7 states now, and they've quarantined big sections of Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio to try and deal with this insect pest. That's a definition of destructive agent. So it gives us the authority in those kind of circumstances to deal with that destructive agent and limit either an insect or pathogen from usually often referred to as an invasive species, but not always.
What do you do if you have another spruce bark beetle invasion? I mean, what's the solution to that?
That's a good question. Through the chair, a lot of the issues having to do with the spruce bark beetle on the Kenai is that it's pretty much killed most of the trees that would serve as a host for that particular insect. Short of having a forest products industry that uses fiber material, either as pulp for paper or a bioenergy industry would use wood chips or wood pellets, that would be a good substitute. And that's something that we are working aggressively to develop in the state as a bioenergy industry.
But I guess my question is, you have the right to go in to prevent or suppress destructive agents.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's an infestation of some insects, let's say spruce bark beetles somewhere, I'm guessing you don't go in and crop dust it with pesticides.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your earlier question. What we would do is, it depends on the insect and depends on it, but if it's a bark beetle, that would typically be probably a pesticide application on the boles of the trees, so when the beetles emerge that they come in contact with that and then die.
Do you crop dust?
We typically don't. We've never done that here in the state, except for the state has never done that. But there's been at least one private landowner that has used herbicides for aerial application for weed control on plantations where they've planted trees. But that's not very common. It's more common in other parts of the country than it is here in Alaska. Another good example would be the spruce budworm, which is an insect that's in the interior right now. In the state of Maine and other places in the lake states, they have aerial sprayed for the budworm as one of the mitigation measures. We just don't have the resources or the need, at least, to do that here in this state. But it depends on the insect or the pathogen you're dealing with and what you might do to actually control it.
Yeah, and I guess I'm just envisioning, I mean, I didn't think you did because you got salmon streams and, I mean, just a host of
right.
other cascading mm-hmm. things that could happen.
Yeah.
Let's go to Jennifer Uhas in Fairbanks. Jennifer, you there?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Jennifer, number one, welcome, and we're certainly nice seeing you the other day and with the kids from the NRA, but if you would put yourself on the record and your affiliation, we'd be proud to hear from you.
For the record, my name is Jennifer Juhas. I am the special assistant to Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker, and we are testifying in favor of this bill.
Okay, Jennifer, is there anything you want to make notice to us on that made you stand up and want to be counted on this issue?
The Division of Forestry came to us while they were drafting this bill, and after the 2004 fire season in the interior, Mayor Whitaker placed a high priority on public information for wildland fire and the division's interaction with the borough as far as mitigating the effects of possible wildland or urban interface over the next few years. The mayor's been highly involved in this process.
Yeah.
Each of the folks on the committee have a reason to think about this legislation, from the Miller's Reach fire in the valley to the Lower Hill site in Anchorage and the growing risk on the coastal zone and the most recent Caribou Hills fire. I know that as a public information officer down in Homer last year, I had the opportunity to return back to some of these recreational cabins that had been overtaken by the fire. And it was really quite an emotional event. These were deemed recreational cabins, but the couple I returned home with had had every one of their family holidays there over the last 15 to 20 years, and their grandchildren really didn't know another venue for those. It was quite an emotional experience to come back to that with them and see the loss. This legislation actually places in the mission statement the expectation that already exists on most of our local communities for the Division of Forestry to assist with this.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. Any questions or comments for Jennifer? Next, we'll go to Mr. Lynn Wilcock. Lynn, I know you just listed some questions. Do you have anything you want to add to the conversation?
Chairman Huggins, first of all, it's good to speak to you again. It's been a number of years. I don't really have anything to add. I think State Forester Mace did a great job of explaining why we're asking for this legislation, but I have been involved in wildland fire for 35 years and in Alaska for the last 30, so if there's any questions that I could answer, I would be more than happy to do so.
Okay, Senator Wagner?
No, I have a question. Back.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Lynn. And it looks like Chris has things under control here, but you stand by it till we conclude the committee. But and good to hear from you again.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator Wagner.
Just a question on spruce bark beetle. And I watched this from the start to current time. What have we learned, and what have we put in place so this doesn't happen and isn't as catastrophic next time?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wagner. That's a fair question. And I think what we've learned is earlier action is appropriate in circumstances where you have the ability to take action through salvage or initial discovery of an outbreak like that. One of the things that the state, I wasn't in the division at the time this happened, but I was in the state, but we do have the authority to declare a zone of infestation, which then gives some other tools that we can use, so to speak, in that toolbox to deal with something like that. Whether it would have made a difference on the Kenai or not, it's hard to say, because I think those forests had reached an age where they were old, they were decadent, and there were large tracts of those forests. You know, it wasn't just isolated pockets. And one of the things, frankly, that probably allowed that to happen was the successful effort at keeping fire out of that ecosystem over the previous decades, where those forests, instead of naturally turning over maybe at a slower rate and in smaller chunks at any given time, it was kind of like laying out a smorgasbord for these insects, and once they got going, there was virtually not a lot that we could do to stop them. The same thing is happening right now in Canada and in Colorado and some of the Rocky Mountain states. There's a tree, a pine, lodgepole pine, that the mountain pine beetle is attacking. And it makes the Kenai look like a small disaster in comparison. Literally in Alberta right now, there are just hundreds of thousands of acres that are being attacked and decimated by this particular insect. The insect never occurred east of the Rockies. It now is on the east side of the Rockies and can attack other pine species in addition to lodgepole pine. So there are some things we can try and make a difference in, and there are other factors at play here in some of these outbreaks that whatever humans decide they may want to do, sometimes we're not successful in responding.
Thank you.
Yeah. Chris, a couple other questions quickly for you. ALMR, do you have ALMR?
Tomorrow morning, finance.
Help us out.
And this is, I assume, the ALMR bill that is for National Guard pay is what we call it. Is that the one you're talking about?
No. Mobile Land Radio. Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. ALMR, that's right. DMVA, I'm getting my initials right. mixed up here. ALMR, yes, we do have, at least in our budget, we do have a chunk of funds that are dedicated to ALMR. And that, of course, is to do with our suppression organization, our fire engines for the most part, but also our area offices. And it's just part of the statewide effort to convert over to that system, as my understanding is mandated by some of the changes in interoperability between federal agencies and state agencies so that we can communicate with each other in emergency situations, right. Be it Homeland Security or right. fire or whatever the situation
but
might
when
be.
You're, as an example, when you're communicating with Alaska National Guard, is UHF or VHF, is that?
This would be a good Lynn question, actually, but I believe it is UHF. But
you say a good Lynn question?
Yeah, this would be a good one for Lynn.
Hey, Lynn, you hear us the question?
Yes, Chairman, I heard the question.
Yeah, could you answer that for us?
ALMR, we are using, I'd say we're still trying to figure out how best to integrate it with our legacy system. The problem with ALMR from our perspective is that it's limited right now to alongside the road net, and of course our wildland fires occur much broader than that, so we're having to maintain our traditional legacy system. However, I do believe that ALMR will help with interoperability should we get that interface fire again. I don't believe we're currently using it to communicate with the National Guard, although I think that capability exists and we'll be exploring that. We are using it to talk to local fire departments and to some more other cooperating agencies.
Okay. Thank. Yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know what a forest fire is. My kids know what a forest fire is. Everyone I know knows what a forest fire is. Who do you think you are changing this from forest fire to wildland fire? I don't even know what that means.
Through the chair, Senator, I think Smokey the Bear has agreed to this change in definition. So, but. Forest fire has been in the vernacular for, you know, ever since Smokey the Bear came into use as a public education tool. But wildland fire is the term that the agencies, suppression agencies, use to describe this these days. And so it's certainly an update of the term. Simply, as I described earlier, is more inclusive of the types of places you may have fire.
Yeah. Any of the committee members ever go to the home of Smokey the Bear?
No.
Right near where Billy the Kid got captured by Pat Garrett down in New Mexico. Yeah, a beautiful place. One final question for me, and then we'll see if there are any other questions. The term, when you let fires burn themselves out, what is that term, and do we exercise that here in the state?
Mr. Chair, generally that's... what we do is those are fires that occur in limited or modified areas, and we simply just monitor those fires. Sometimes we might take action on a particular
fire. What do you call them?
We just monitor the fires. So essentially it's a let burn policy. Let some burn. People okay. call it that. Okay. It's not quite as simple as that. It's not just we stand back and let it go. We're right. actively still managing the fire. And often we will take a look at resources, the cost, the values at risk. Every fire that escapes initial attack has what we call a wildland fire situation analysis completed that essentially is the strategic tactical document that we use to guide how we're going to suppress and manage that fire.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wagner?
What's the difference between a let burn fire and a controlled burn?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wagner, a controlled fire is one that has actually had quite a bit of preparatory work done. And often takes us a year to write what's called a burn plan that actually dictates how we're going to ignite the fire, under what conditions, you know, only under a certain set of conditions we actually light that fire. Whereas a let burn is generally a fire that occurs either naturally by lightning or human caused, but it we don't dictate all the rest of it. It just happens as a matter of course, and then if the opportunity is right, then we'll use that term let burn to manage that as a fire that will benefit that ecosystem and not threaten other values that are at risk. It's a delicate balance between damage and benefit when a fire's allowed to burn.
Where I was trying to go is, I guess I should ask the question a little different. Does a let burn fire ever become a controlled burn fire?
No.
Okay, Senator Wilkowski. But before Senator Wilkowski asks a question, you have a rather gray beard. How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing this now, actually the fire stuff, only since I came to the state, which is only about, I'm going to be almost 9 years since I've
really? Come. Really? What were you doing to get such a gray beard?
You know, I think it was the 04 fire season that did it to me,
okay.
And it was quickly followed by the 05. And I also, hate to admit, take blood pressure pills now, too. And I think that was the 04 fire season.
Okay, Senator Wilkowski.
I have a couple questions. Does the Anchorage Hillside qualify as a wildland fire?
The terminology, yes. You'd call it an urban interface fire if you're really being particular, but a wildland fire would be any land that ignites and burns.
And then in 4115.010, the intent section, you're changing the values, but you're also adding in other destructive agents, so it enables you now to provide protection from other destructive agents. Is that a big change, or is that just kind of clarifying what you currently do?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator. No, that actually was other destructive agents has been in this section all along. So this is just the part of the statute that makes a reference both to fire and destructive agents, which is part of the forest practices section. And it's actually referred to more in the forest practices section of the statute. And you can see further down, we actually define what the destructive agent was, and that was at the request of House Resources. They were a little concerned that destructive agent wasn't narrowly defined enough, so that's where that definition comes from under Section 5.
But the addition of adding destructive agents to 010, that you don't see that as having being any giving you any sort of new powers, do you?
Through the chair, no, that does not give us any additional new powers.
Okay, Derek, do you have any concluding comments?
Mr. Chairman, no, I do not. No, I do not.
Okay, thank you. Questions or comments from committee members? Senator Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, I still don't like the idea of getting rid of the word forest fires, but I'll move that we move House Bill number 370 out of the committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Very good. Is there any objections to that? Seeing none, it will move out of committee. Just remind members of the committee that on Wednesday we'll take up the Fish Board nominees first and then bills previously heard. And then on Friday we will hear from the Alberta experts to include the government, industry, and Enbridge on oil sands. And that should be quite interesting. Looking forward to that. Thank you very much for today, and we're adjourned.